You're listening to I'm Not Steve Kerr on the Believe Podcast Network. Now here are your hosts, the Resch Brothers, Colin and Scott.
Brothers don't shake hands. Brothers got a hug.
Welcome, everyone. The first live program, I'm Not Steve Kerr, episode 14. Those of you joining us, see, there's a few of you. This is going to be a fun show. Hopefully, you're finishing up dinner and can join us, chat with us, because we've got a fun one. An old friend of mine joining the program. You can grab a beer like we're going to be doing. It is dinner time here on the West Coast, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock Mountain Time, where Scott's going to be coming to us from. And speaking of, let's bring these guys in right now. Scott on the right. My
Yo.
Man, Corky Gainsford in the middle.
What's going on, guys?
Hey, the first live program for I'm Not Steve Kerr. Giving this thing a shot. Don't know how that opening intro went. We'll check it on the replay.
We'll know later.
This is a nice Resch Brothers sandwich we got going on.
The cool thing about doing this on StreamYard, which obviously this is live on YouTube, Facebook Live, and Periscope, which Periscope, by the way, goes away in 2 weeks. I just learned that today. Twitter's doing away with Periscope on March 31st. I had no idea. Here's another angle, so we can do that. That looks kind of cool. Now you're up with me, Cork.
Yeah.
So Scott is in Park City. Corky coming to us from Las Vegas, Nevada. And everyone that's joining us, please bear with us. I think this is going to freeze from time to time, but those who are going to be listening on the podcast, we've got the audio taken care of. So if you're driving in your car listening to this in the coming days, it'll be clean. But for those watching live, like I said, it's not going to be the best, but we're going to have fun with this. Corky's in Las Vegas, where he just told me, yeah, what are you cracking right now? So
don't hurt yourself there.
This is a Corona. I don't get hangovers from Coronas.
Hey, you know what works.
Okay.
Go
exactly.
With what works.
So you've got a beach beer, and I don't know why, but I went with a beach beer today, too. I'm at this local store, and I'm like, oh, Fire Rock. Kona sounds good. Maybe we just wish we were on a beach somewhere. I don't know.
Always. That's like the best part on tour is when you have tour days on the beach. That makes everything better for like the next several days.
Right, so best stop you ever had, Blue Man Group.
Virginia Beach and Tampa, they were both beach days. We had days off at the beach, and those were always the best.
Okay. Yeah. Scott, what are you drinking tonight?
Well, I'm trying to one-up you guys with a little Old Elk Manhattan here.
Oh.
Actually, the truth is I ran out of beer, but
okay.
there's nothing wrong with a little Manhattan, so...
Absolutely.
Be just fine. I'm going to be just fine.
Can appreciate that. So Corky and I go way back, as does Scott and Corky, actually, same amount of time, right? We all went to high school together. Corky was in my grade. Scott was a year older than us. And, man, we've got some stories that are going to be fun to tell tonight. And
yes.
maybe some more fun than others.
Well, what I remember is I played soccer and ran track and played basketball, and we had a decent basketball team in Old Monroe, Washington. And in eighth grade, there was a solid like eight or nine of us that had played together for a few years. And somehow in eighth grade, I ended up being a starter on our junior varsity team, which was interesting, but I was never the greatest basketball player, but I hustled a lot, and I think I earned the starting position that way. And then in ninth grade, this guy named Colin shows up that never seen before, never met before, plays basketball, and obviously plays way better than me at the same position.
Mm-hmm.
And so instantly I was like, well, I'm not going to be a starter this year. And then what made matters even worse was we had a teacher who was our coach named Dave Brecky, who did not believe in basketball players having long hair.
Yeah.
And I had hair that went right kind of past my shoulders. And Dave pulled me aside and said, if I wanted to play basketball for his team, I'd have to cut my hair. And very rock and roll moment that has continued in many aspects of my life to this day, I said, I don't feel like cutting my hair. So not only did I move out of the starting lineup, I moved down to third string and didn't play any time that entire year. Because I refused to cut my hair.
Now the question is,
The question is,
would you have cut your hair had you been a starter?
That's a very interesting question. I just remember I'd been focusing more and more on music, and I'd been taking drum lessons at that point for a few years, and I remember going to my drum lesson and asking my drum teacher what he thought, and he had like super long hair, and he was like, "What, were they gonna make Jesus cut his hair because it wasn't long, or, you know, because it was too long?" That kind of thing. He thought it was the most funny thing ever. So, I decided after sitting on the bench for a full season that the band was having a lot more fun playing songs, and there were a lot more girls over there. So I figured that might be a better spot for me in the upcoming years. So Colin took over all the guard stuff on our basketball team, and I went and played drums instead.
It worked out all right.
It was funny because I've told that story and people thought that I was pissed at Colin. I was like, dude, that was the best thing that ever happened to me. Like, I had no business being on the basketball team. Soccer.
You gave
me
direction.
Yeah. But like, Colin was like, dude, seriously, like, you belong over here. And I was like, thank you.
Well, it is funny, right? Because I remember, here's what I remember. I don't remember your hair and all that. I remember... Yeah. That the very first game when our freshman year, I didn't start. Preston Sprinkle started in front of me. Yep. And I remember coming home thinking, oh, my God, I'm like 100 times better than Preston. I'm like, I'm going to crush this dude in practice every day until Brecky figures it out. And he, like, the next day figured it out. I was like, Colin, you're starting.
Yeah.
and so I guess I didn't know I did this to you, too. But you went on to do what you've done in life, which is amazing. And Preston is, like, as we know, one of the smartest people ever. Is what, a doctor in New York these days. I'm sure you've stayed in touch with Preston. But I think things have worked out at least the way they were supposed to for all of us.
Totally. Totally. We all found the spot. That's where, like, because I have a kid. My oldest is in eighth grade going into ninth grade next year. And I keep telling her that, like, when the things that she's not sure about in life, she'll start figuring out very quickly, because a lot of us had some transitional moments when high school came around.
Right.
So
right.
that was definitely a year for me where that happened, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I still remember, I think this would have been our senior year, so Scott was probably gone, but when you really started to get into the music scene, you had a band called Pandora's Dream. Remember that?
Oh, yes.
And I remember you played, it was either once or twice at this.
It was what would you call it? It was the Valley Rally Fitness Club.
Valley Rally Fitness Club. Yeah. You got it for the night, and you guys played, and we had a good turn. It must have been like 100 people there. Or at least it felt like it. You know?
It was some real DIY stuff, like very punk rock, where there were no venues, obviously, in Monroe, Washington, and someone along the way had discovered that, you know, there's a open space and a stage at this local fitness club, and they would, you know, do their aerobics or whatever in this room, but there was a stage and a space where people could gather, and so we fully, like, rented out the space, whatever few hundred bucks they charge us to rent the space for the evening. We bought yellow shirts and printed, like, event staff on the back. So, like, my parents were event staff, and Will Wakefield's parents and a few other friends of our parents, that kind of thing. So we had the staff, and we sold tickets out of our leather jackets while walking around school, and we would put posters around the school, and people would come up to us like, "Hey, can you got some tickets?" Yeah, and they're like $3 a piece or whatever. If we would have thought about this, I have some of those tickets that I found in the garage. But it was 200 or 300 kids there. And we did it junior year and senior year at the very end of the year. I have them on video. They've been converted to digital tapes. I haven't posted them online yet, but those concerts, I have them digitized and saved, and I should put them up one of these days. It's pretty entertaining.
Well, yeah, man. And this is a lot of what we're going to talk about, is all the things you've been doing really since the pandemic began, right?
Yep.
Is you've started, you know, a site for your art. You've got the BMX stuff going on. So that could be the next thing. You're taking all these old VHS tapes and like, hey, let's put them out to the masses. Like, why not? We finally had time in our lives. Here's we're in our 40s to do something like this, and you went and did it.
Pretty much, yeah. Like, I'd had some opportunity over the years, but really, like, it's funny. It's been like a three-part process because my dad and another friend's dad were really the two people that videotaped all these races in the late 80s to like mid 90s. And there's not hardly any of that from that BMX era that's on YouTube or online, really.
Yeah.
And so that was part one. Part two is my parents own a VHS to DVD converter. And mm-hmm. so it's been my mom who's taken up the task of like, we have all these boxes of VHS tapes and they no longer belong in this house. So she just like puts one in, hits record, leaves for a couple hours, comes back and hits stop. And then after a few weeks, just brings this box of DVDs over to my house with the VHS tapes and says, make sure the DVDs are okay. Throw away the VHS tapes when you're done. Yep. Or let me know if I have to redo them. And then, you know, I'll digitize them and then separate the races and put them all up. And it's been really cool because like there's a bunch of old BMX friends from over the years that we've kept in touch or got in touch online through whether it's, you know, Facebook or Instagram or whatever. And it's been a cool way to just kind of reconnect with some of those guys that, I mean, we were racing in that circuit 20 years ago and all this footage has been sitting on my VHS tapes in a box somewhere. So like, you know, no one's seen these races. Like, oh, I don't even remember this race, you know, half the time.
Here we go. Yes.
So Colin's popping up a race from 1993, and this is a good one that I just posted the other day where me and one of my rival competitors are racing, and this is in a qualifier heat, and I'm not too happy about him trying to catch some style in front of me, so I'm not really going to let him beat me in this race. You'll see in the last turn.
Boom.
Yeah, we made some.
Wait, that's not legal?
That actually is legal.
Okay. Because
we were even and or I was ahead of him when the contact was made. And when you're ahead of the other person, you have right of way. So it wasn't the softest hit by any means, but it was a solid hit. But you know, bumping elbows is always nice and clean. If you're going to get DQ'd, it's more about hitting someone from behind. If you hit them from behind and they go over a turn, you'll get DQ'd. If you crash them from behind. And it's funny, I have footage of this same dude hitting me from behind and him getting DQ'd. But right here.
Get off
boom.
Me.
One of the old racers that saw, he goes, dude, it was like you were a buffalo and he was a feather. Just gone.
Well, the other what I noticed watching that video the other day is you've probably, if you've really watched it and listened, there's a guy in the crowd who's yelling at, what were they, umpires or refs, like, you better call that, man! You better call that! He's like screaming, like, for you to get DQ'd.
The irony is that one weekend, my team Powerlight and his team Haro were literally sitting, our tents were next to each other in the stands. So the entire weekend, Team Powerlight and Team Haro are sitting next to each other, and then that move was made. So yeah, it's crystal clear that they were not happy about that.
That's funny. Hey, everybody tuning in, we want to hear from you. This is a live stream. You can chat. You can send comments to us. We'll even put them up on the screen. If you've got something for Corky as we go along here, let us know. And if it's a good enough question or comment, we'll put it up. But I'm going to add another one to the stream here since we're talking BMX, Cork. So you were one of the – always ranked like first or second through high school in the world. I remember this. And you did this all the way through your Stanford days. Is that correct?
In Stanford, I slowed down a bunch. I turned pro, but only because I knew I could make a little bit of money in the pro class, in the rookie pro class in particular. The guys that did it as a career – that was on a different level. So here we are, same year, 1993 World Championships. This is in Holland, and the finals here.
And you're in the yellow and orange right there.
I was in the yellow winning going into the first turn, and we all crash.
And this dude cruises home.
Yeah, this dude right here in the red and white, he was actually in my qualifier motos. So I'd raced him in all three qualifier motos. I'd raced him in our eights, in our quarters, in our semi. He hadn't beaten me once all weekend. But we both made it to the final. And then when it gets to the final, he has an outside lane, goes around the outside of the crash, and ends up winning the world championships. Right. It was literally the only race he won. Olympic speed skating races
a lot of times, right?
Yeah.
Look at this guy. Look at his hair, man.
He's like, that's the length that mine was when Brecky told me to cut it. It was that length.
Okay. All right. Here it is again, the replay in slow motion.
But yeah, so there's a dude, the guy on the inside of me, that's Daniel from Holland. I raced him in a bunch of the world championships over the years. There's another Christophe from France is in there. It's funny, like there was a bunch of guys that we would never race each other except for the world championships. So I've known some of those racers over the decades. And Daniel, the Australian guy that ends up crashing with me in the front there, like he's another one that I've kept in touch with on Facebook over the years. So we'll like toss videos back and forth of like random stuff. But yeah, like I wouldn't ever see him. And then you get to the world championships. And the best part about the worlds is like you never knew how fast the other guys were going to be or how you were going to stack up. You would just go and hope for the best. And I got fifth in the world when I was 13. I got fourth when I was 9. I ended up getting up and getting third that one where we all crashed. And then the following year I got second where I was in second, went into first, got passed back and ended up getting second in the end. But it was a cool little, the worlds were always the best, you know, like just racing. You couldn't talk to, no, there was no trash talking because you didn't understand what half the people were saying backstage. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, right.
It was great. And like I say, a bunch of those guys, like you would catch them over the years. And by the time like the mid 90s rolled around, a bunch of foreigners were coming into the U.S. to race in the U.S. circuit, France in particular, England, Australia. And a bunch of those guys stayed in the U.S. and made a full career going through like the mid late 90s out of BMX and X Games and that kind of stuff. It was super cool to be a part of.
Hey, we got our old friend Tate Kyle chiming in on Facebook. Hey, Tate, what's up, man? Corky, those were cruisers versus smaller frames, right?
Let's see. On the two clips, Colin just showed those were 20-inch frames, but it was typical for us to race cruiser and 20-inch. So. There's footage of both those types of bikes and it literally it's a 24 inch wheel versus a 20 inch wheel. But you know, those allowed us to race twice as much, you know, there's twice as many world champions when you have a cruiser class and a 20 inch class and that kind of thing. So yeah, like that year in Holland, I actually got third in cruiser and got third in 20 inch. But that was a fun little time for sure. And as you were alluding to, like when I left high school and went to college, part of what happened was I was already kind of getting out of BMX and knowing that I wanted to focus on music, but I felt like I'd missed a lot of high school by racing, which I did. Like,
yeah.
I mean, because basically every Friday I was flying somewhere in the country to go race, and then I'd fly back either Sunday night or Monday morning. I'd miss way more school than was supposedly allowed, but I get, you know, I was like, but I'm getting A's, so you're, you know, it's okay to have 20 absences, right? Because I'm still getting A's in these classes. But but like by the time I hit college, like I just knew that I wanted to not miss college the same way that I missed high school. And I knew going into Stanford that it was like going to be a completely different field of people that I was competing against just to get halfway decent grades and graduate. So it definitely became, BMX became more of a hobby when I hit college, and I turned pro on a whim. So like I was saying, so I could make a little bit of money in the rookie pro class, which was basically like spending money, and got picked up by Powerlite again and raced for Powerlite for another year while I was in college, which was a lot of fun too. It was a really, really cool team. And some of the guys on Powerlite became Olympic medalists and, you know, national pro champions and all that kind of stuff. It was a cool team for sure.
Now, were you so good because of your athletic ability or because you stripped the paint off those bikes and customized them?
to get them more lightweight?
Yeah, there must have been something going on there.
I was competitive because I didn't have a lot of fear. The worst thing in BMX is like, especially like in any sport, is like fearing of falling down or being afraid of, you know, being afraid of winning is a lot easier than being afraid of losing. You know what I mean? Like you the hardest part is guys that were fast going out there and not believing that they could win. So, it was just a lot of that, like a lot of mental stuff. And I just like to jump and ride and go fast. Like my biggest downfall in BMX was that I hated lifting weights. So there were times where like my conditioning wasn't up to where it needed to be, or, you know, maybe my strength at certain times, but I just like to ride and I like to go fast, but man, I hated the weight room.
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes two of us.
Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, we're going to obviously get into a lot here. And again, for everyone that's joining us for this live broadcast, send your comments our way on Facebook Live, on YouTube, on Periscope. We want to hear from you. We got our old friend Corky Gainsford, Corky G, with us for episode 14 of I'm Not Steve Kerr. And Cork, you know, we talked last week for a good hour, and our stories are very similar to kind of what we've been experiencing in the last year, right? When it comes to the pandemic, we've both been, you know, unemployed. You were with the Blue Man Group. Obviously, you know, I'd like you to tell people what's gone on with the Blue Man Group, because you hear that name, you're like, oh, world powerhouse. But the pandemic has absolutely crushed the entertainment business, the media business. I have so many colleagues in TV where I was for so long that have been laid off that you don't even hear about. The Golden State Warriors laid off 10% of their staff in January. You don't even hear about it, right? One of the richest pro sports franchises in the world is laying people off. I mean, so it's a real thing. We've kind of felt it, obviously, firsthand. And we're weathering the storm because it's going to come back at some point, right? But it's been a long time, longer than we thought. So tell people, you've been with Blue Man Group for 20-plus years. It's an amazing story. One, how you became a member of the Blue Man Group, kind of like, whatever, here we go, to doing it, basically making it the backbone of your career while you did all these other things. But tell people how you started Blue Man Group and what has happened, especially in the last year, and especially the last show. I've got video of that I can pop up too.
For sure. Well, I got involved with Blue Man as a result of the dot-com bust, which was, you know, the other boom and bust that we lived through. I was living in the San Francisco area, graduated college, and all of us were working in various dot-com companies, 98% of which probably don't even exist anymore. So we'd ridden that wave, and the dot-com bust had happened. Everybody got laid off, and nobody in the Bay Area in particular was hiring. So one day after sending, I think I was sending like 20 some odd resumes a week trying to find any companies that were hiring, none of which were. I saw an ad in the paper. It was like a little tiny quarter page ad in the weekly paper in San Francisco that just said Blue Man Group looking for drummers and guitar players. And I knew of their Intel ads at the time, but I'd never seen any of the shows. And thankfully, I had a roommate whose girlfriend had seen the show in Boston. And she was like, I really think you should go down and audition for this thing. And so I didn't know what I was auditioning for, but I knew I had no other job prospects. So there was literally nothing to lose by going and standing in line all morning. And there was several hundred of us in that line, and they'd auditioned in LA, San Francisco, and Seattle. And when it came down to it, after our first, second, third, fourth round auditions, they ended up hiring two drummers, which was me and Tim Alexander, the drummer from Primus. So I was laughing because I was like, you mean like the guy that I kind of like used to play along to his CDs, like you're hiring me and that guy? And they're like, yeah, that's who we're going to hire. And then I show up, and little did I know that only a few months prior they had auditioned in Las Vegas, and the one guy they hired from Las Vegas was Blas Elias from Slaughter, who was another guy who I'd learned to play drums to playing to Slaughter records. So
yeah.
So ironically, the first time my parents ever saw the Blue Man show, there was one side of the stage with three drummers all playing next to each other, and I was in the middle, and Blas was on one side, and Tim was on the other on the very first show that they saw. So that was like a little going full circle moment. So that was back in 2001. I did a national tour with Blue Man in 2003 called the Complex Rock Tour, which if you look in the very back corner of the screen here, let's see if my finger can go to the right spot. Right there, there's actually a platinum plaque for the DVD that we did that year. We had it actually went 4 times platinum, which was super, super awesome. And to this day, the only platinum plaque that I've earned in the music business. So like a little, that's always on the wall somewhere where in my rooms. But I did that tour with them. I did a handful of appearances on like The Tonight Show and America's Got Talent, Last Call with Carson Daly, and I played the Latin Grammy Awards with Ricky Martin. That was good. That was a good time. Ricky Martin is a fine individual. That was fun. And so it's just gone over the years, and like I had to leave my full-time gig with Blue Man when I signed a record deal with Otherwise, because I was on the road with other, like, we were on the road 9 or 10 months out of the year.
Yeah.
So
right.
I had to leave my full-time job with Blue Man, but what would happen is when I would come home from Otherwise tours, Blue Man would throw me right back into the circuit, and I'd go back into playing shows. So that was super, super cool of them, something that they definitely didn't have to do. The last thing I did is what Colin's showing a clip of was the national tour that started at the end of 2019, or the fall of 2019, I should say, and went right up to when the pandemic started.
Yep.
So this was a fully new show that Blue Man was doing. Lots of new pieces in the Blue Man scope of things, lots of new music. Me and the guys that were in the band on that tour, we had to learn a lot, but we also had to kind of create a lot and craft the music. And really, we were given a pretty soft template of how things were going, and we were able to kind of structure and fine-tune what the template was going to be as the tour went on. So that was a lot of fun. And just
for clarification, you've never been a Blue Man.
You're
in the suit. Just so people that don't know, you've never been a Blue
Man.
You're on the drums, and that's you. Whatever you're doing for each particular show.
You can see the Blue Man tiny in the top of the screen. Yep. That's kind of where it looks like from our point of view. But I've always been one of the neon guys in the back. As I like to say, the Blue Men are primarily actors, and they can, you know, drum some, and there's a certain drumming ability that they need. But their primary thing that they look for in Blue Man is a lot of acting skills and really close interactions and identifying with the audience from night to night. So the Blue Men have to work very hand in hand with people in the audience every night, read the situation and make a connection closely with the audience. And we're the shaman in the background, kind of setting the audio stage for what's happening for the Blue Men up front.
Right. Right.
So it's a different style of music as a whole. Drumming, it's very tribal, lots of like, you know, almost like jungle tribal beats in the background supporting what they're doing up front. But we're supposed to be kind of like that voice in the back of their head as they're going through the show night to night.
So I saw you and you brought up, you know, you pointed there, 2003. I went to the show in Charlotte. I went to the show in Atlanta. I was living in Charlotte at the time. So I met up with you for a couple shows back then. I mean, I've probably seen you live, your Vegas show, probably 4 times.
Right.
All cold now, you know, it's such a fun show. If you haven't seen the Blue Man Group live, you're missing out, right? But what are the state of things now as we sit here today on March, 15th of 2021?
Yeah, and this is, like you're saying, it's almost exactly, we're a few days over 1 year since the last show that I played, which was funny because, we were in Syracuse, New York, which is, you know, upstate of where it was really starting to hit in the U.S. And literally the show is loaded in for our Syracuse shows and we're walking to soundcheck. And then we all get a text saying, you guys should head back to the hotel instead. And had a meeting. And then a few hours later, we were having a different meeting. And then we were all getting handed plane tickets and flying home the next day.
Mm.
And the crew stayed behind one extra day to tear down the set. And then they were gone too. Vegas has been, as everyone knows, like it's been shut down largely, especially like the shows, the Cirque du Soleil shows, all that kind of stuff where there's a large audience. Those have all been primarily shut down due to capacity restrictions and everything. The tour has been rescheduled several times, but as with any, you know, rock tour, Live Nation, whatever, everything's largely coming back as the latest schedule is in the fall. I know the Vegas shows are loosely supposed to come back by like July 4th weekend, but everything's still super tentative. The Blue Man Tour could come back in the fall. It could come back next spring. It could be back next summer. It's just a matter of like when tours come back in particular, there's going to be all the tours that have been on hold for the last year are all going to be back trying to get back on the road again at the exact same time, vying for the exact same rooms.
Hadn't even thought about that.
Yeah. So so it's going to be tricky and how they figure out not only the restrictions of what's happening within the audience, but literally just scheduling all the shows on top of each other is going mm-hmm. to be a tricky thing, which is why I say like, maybe tours will be coming back in the fall, but Blue Man might not be one of those fall tours. Blue Man might be in a second wave or a third wave or that kind of thing, depending upon how the scheduling goes and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
And like I say, Vegas, the smaller shows have started coming back within the last month or two. The bigger shows I know are hopefully, fingers crossed, coming back in the summer. But you know, they're probably going to come back with smaller schedules. The staff will probably be smaller. You know, will I be involved in that first or second wave of Blue Man cast? Maybe, maybe not. You know, it's like everything's completely up in the air. And you know, so like you were saying, like due to the pandemic and what's been going on, there's no drumming gigs, right? So I've been starting an art company, starting an apparel company. I've been trying to release more of my independent like rock music and getting that out there. Just any project that I can do creatively, both because it's fun, but also because like we need to find income streams somehow. So, yeah. It's funny, like Colin's pulling up my website on the stream here. My website gets more,
got rid of
more
Scott.
And more
perfect.
My website gets more and more confusing the more tasks I take on, yeah. but I do my best to have it up there at CorkyG.com. And there's links to like my discography, videos of me playing drums, videos of my band Code Red Riot where I'm the singer, and then like links to the artwork, links to Delete Designs, which is the apparel company. I mean, I've been all over the place recently, and as a creative, like my goal, and I was talking with this about some other friends of mine in a band called Devour the Day, and they're like, what drives us is being creative. It isn't necessarily like one thing or being on stage or recording or what. It's the fact that we get to wake up in the morning and be creative in some outlet or another.
Yeah.
And it spreads you thin sometimes trying to get all those bases covered, but at the same point in time, it's super fulfilling trying to, you know, keep your hands in all these baskets and, you know, like I've been focusing on my art the last few weeks, both with that website for CorkyGArt.com, also finishing canvases, selling and shipping canvases, and then with the whole NFT craze that happened over the last little bit, where people are selling their art digitally online, I'm scrambling and trying to be involved in that NFT space, and mm-hmm. that all occurred over the last week and a half, where my old manager of Otherwise called me up saying, dude, I like your art. You really need to be selling NFTs. And I'm like, what are NFTs?
Yeah.
So, like you're saying, Colin, like it's a lot of scrambling and a lot of eggs in a lot of baskets. But, you know, as a freelancer and creative, it's been, you know, monetarily it hasn't been the greatest year, but creatively and fulfillment wise, it's actually been quite a cool year to have that time available and mental space available to be able to reach out into these areas that I've wanted to and never felt like I had the time to do it. You know, that's been a huge bonus.
Yeah. It seems you've probably found different realms in your art that you probably couldn't get to before, 'cause you were so, you know, busy with music and everything that you couldn't explore.
Yeah, I mean, because you know, just from regular gigs, like I would work 30 hours a week, let's say, doing gigs, whether it's cover bands on Fremont or Blue Man shows, or I was working in a show called Tenors of Rock on the Strip and a show called Raiding the Rock Vault on the Strip. So you're going to gigs and setting up drums at some of these places, and you know, thankfully, the like, good God, drum techs are the best thing ever because you don't have to set up. But like, it's hours and hours and hours you spent doing this. Whereas like during the pandemic, like I just tore apart our garage and set it up as an entire art studio and just could do whatever I wanted there. And I had the hours available to do it and focus on it and try to perfect some of these techniques along the way, where it would have been much more difficult to do that while also working, you know, full time as a drummer.
Well, some of your artwork is directly behind you.
Yep.
We can see it, you know, in your shot. And then your shirt, show your shirt. So your designs, these T-shirt designs, you've got some really cool stuff. And this is like, I know this is your big seller, right? I mean, it makes sense.
This is our most popular design. And as with most things in art, what I thought was my stupidest idea is my biggest seller. Because I put this up as a joke. I thought it was funny because this is our entire lives as musicians, is when we're learning songs, you know, it's loosely going to go something like this.
Yeah.
And for musicians, especially like my friends in Las Vegas, where we're playing in a million cover bands and every week we're learning a handful of new songs, like that's the process, you know, what's verse, chorus, bridge, chorus, right? So I thought that shirt was funny, and I pulled up the idea and posted it, and next thing I know, like, it's been selling all over the place. But yeah, like, I just stumbled on to various things, and I was like, I've always wanted to work with, you know, Adobe Illustrator, and I was like, I have these ideas, and I have these, like, half-drawn concepts and all this kind of stuff, like, you know, if I have time, I might as well put them into a legit idea and put them up online and be able for people to buy them. So it's also like, frankly, at a certain point in time, you run out of shirts to wear on stage, and like, you got to find them. And we were in the middle of a pandemic where we couldn't go shopping. So what was my next best idea was basically create a bunch of shirts that I would want to wear on stage, and then just have my own line of clothing at the same point in time.
Right,
so,
right.
It was like when I started out, it was like a win-win thing. I was like, I need some more shirts. All these other ones are getting old and worn out. And next thing you know, I have a clothing line. So it's not on the links here, but it's at Delete Design. Oh, there it is. Yeah. Going across the bottom. DeleteDesigns.com. Takes you there. And there's all sorts of fun stuff. I made like some Christmas presents. I did a shirt that had our ridiculously small dog on the shirt, and gave him his presents to the family. And you know, I've had some fun with it. My dad, who I don't know if you remember my dad from back in the day,
I remember your dad.
He was the gorilla, right? In basketball practice, we'd go in there, and he was the gorilla. He'd always be like the guy, like guarding the big center, guarding Craig Sasser. So
Squatch. Squatch makes an appearance in the podcast.
So he runs a personal fitness company. So he wanted a logo done and some shirts done. So I, you know, created a logo for him and that kind of thing. That was a lot of fun. He's in his like, you know, mid late 60s. And so how many personal trainers are of that age when, you know, and so he has a very specific client list, and it's a bunch of people of that age looking for personal training. And there's someone, you know, in that realm, you know, training them now. So it's been a really cool thing for him to do. And he's been psyched. So, and I was like, dude, I'll do a logo for you. I got you.
I got nothing but time, man.
I got nothing but time. Let me put a fitness logo together.
Well, I mean, I've always told people that to me, you're one of the most talented people that I've ever met. Obviously, you had the BMX stuff going on. You become this world-renowned musician. You've traveled the world. You've done you've opened for, I remember you telling me years ago, you know, at festivals, you opened for Korn, you know, that type of thing in front of thousands of people. And then otherwise, obviously, I saw you here in 2014. I'm going to try to throw this video up too, because I took this video. And tell me about this song in particular. You told me when we were talking on the phone last week, but it's called Soldiers, and it's it became an anthem. And I'm actually surprised it didn't get more traction, even though it's gotten worldwide traction. But here in the States, to me, it just seems like something that should have been in so many movies, you know?
Yeah, therein lies the positives and negatives of the music business, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was funny. Like, we wrote that song and recorded it in my garage, and we thought it would be an awesome live song. It has, like, a long build to it and all this kind of stuff. It felt like it would be a really cool live experience, and from the time that we first played it, people really latched onto that song. And when we handed a demo to this guy named Jose Mangan, who was the program director at Sirius Octane on satellite radio, I can't remember if it's like the second or third song on the CD, but we literally hand him the CD with Sharpie written on it, you know, otherwise. And we never intended that song to be a single, but he really latched onto that song as well and started spinning it on Octane. And within a few months, we became the first band, the first unsigned band to ever go to number one on satellite radio. And so, obviously, when that was happening, that all the record labels started calling up. We signed our deal and had to get a record out really quickly because we had barely an album's worth of material, but we had no album recorded, and we had a song that was on the top of the charts. And so it was just like a real rush experience. And from the moment we were signing that deal, we were off and running. And really, like, Soldiers is a song that never stops. Like, it's, I can't even remember what the number is, but like the streaming numbers are, it's like a million a month or some crazy number like that. Like it just never stops. And for a band that had what we felt was like a pretty decent catalog, like, that song always stuck out. So, Soldiers was always a cool song. I know I have footage of us playing it in front of like 20,000 people, and footage of us playing in little clubs and all sorts of good stuff. But like,
yeah.
I left that band after a couple album cycles, but it, you know, that song never stops. It's pretty crazy.
Yeah. Well, what did you tell me recently? What did it just eclipse a certain number?
We're waiting for the official certification, but there should be an official announcement of a very cool nature in short amount of time. I just can't announce it until we get said certificate check mark in hand.
Right.
But it's about to bypass a certain pinnacle that we will be very psyched and surprised about. That's Ryan, the guitar player there.
Yeah.
This footage is from the Rock on the Range Festival, which is now called Sonic Temple. But it happens usually every May in Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah, Ohio, yeah.
And this is the second stage. It's not even the main stage. The main stage is in the stadium. The second stage is right outside the stadium. And there's like 20,000 some odd people there. You know, it's crazy, like, looking back at it, because when you're there, it just looks like this sea. And it still just looks like a sea of people. But there we are. That's yours truly.
There you are.
trying to keep everybody on pace and in the right place, right? That's the job of the drummer.
Yeah.
But it's fun. It's fun, man. Those festivals are the best, because you go, not only are you playing in front of a huge crowd, but like, there's autograph lines and photo moments and all that kind of stuff, where you really get to interact with a lot of people. And those are the same people that come to the club shows after the fact. And usually, like, the signings, we've been in there doing signings and photos for like 2, 3, 4 hours at times, depending upon the festival. There was one in Indiana where I remember specifically we spent 6 hours at the merch table signing autographs and taking photos. But it was like, if the people wanted to show up, we wouldn't leave until the line was done or we were getting kicked out. So that was a lot of fun, man. That's the best.
So otherwise, you know, is no more for you now. Tell people what you get. Code Red Riot, you started when, and where is Code Red Riot now? Because you're coming out with music, new music. a lot in this last year.
For sure. So what happened was I left Otherwise and started recording and finishing a bunch of new material myself, because I'd always been a songwriter and, you know, multi-instrumentalist. Most of my job in Otherwise was as a drummer and songwriter, but when you are the drummer, people assume you have no songwriting abilities and or songwriting contribution. So,
but you sing as well, not just the. I mean, you can play pretty much every instrument. Am I wrong?
At varying skill levels, yes.
Sure.
So, but honestly, like when it gets into like songwriting and production and whatnot, like everyone assumes the drummer doesn't do anything. Like if you look at songwriting credits, 80% of the time it's the singer, and the other 20% of the time it's the singer and guitar player, and then that's usually it on who's ever credited as a songwriter. But in that band, the singer, guitar player, and I really were the primary writing forces. So when I left that band, my goal was to prove that I could write, that I could produce, that I could record, all that kind of stuff. So I started doing that and put together a batch of material and started sending it out to my old contacts, my old record label, my old lawyer, all that stuff. And their response was, "Hey man, this music's pretty good. Who's singing?" And I'm like, "Well, it's me that's singing." And they're like, "Well, you should start a band." And so what started as me wanting to have a calling card as a producer and a songwriter so I could start working with other bands turned into me starting a band and signing another record deal. So it wasn't the intention, but next thing I knew, that's where I'm at. And so I ended up recording a record and releasing it on Sony, which had bought out Century Media Records by the time that record came out. I did one record with them, and then it was released at a bit of an odd time and a bit of a transition for the record label as a whole, and it wasn't really the right spot for me. So thankfully, I was able to get out of that deal. And everything I've been releasing through the pandemic, I've been able to release independently. So recording the songs on my own, doing the videos on my own, sometimes hiring out some friends to do some video stuff. This one, I actually, the weapon video that you're showing, yeah. I'm in a hotel room. So that the footage of me singing is using the lamp in the hotel room as my light fixture. And then I recorded it at like half speed, uh-huh. and then sped myself up back to normal speed. So I'm singing real slowly, and it's super absurd when you watch back at it. like the legit real-time footage looks absolutely absurd, but I wanted it to be real scattered and weird and jittery when I played it back. And then since I was on tour, all this other footage is like, there's a ton of video sites out there that have stock footage that you can use, or footage that you can, use for whatever purpose and pay them a small fee, that kind of thing. So I just started acquiring a bunch of stock footage and put together a video, which was finished by the time I was still on tour. And the next thing you know, the pandemic hit, and I'm like, well, I can't release new music now. So
yeah.
This was supposed to get released early 2020, and didn't get released until fall of 2020, when it felt like there was some time and space to start releasing new music again.
Do you edit this? Are you editing? So you do it all.
Yeah. So it's fun. I mean, you know, I went to the school of YouTube and watched a bunch of YouTube videos on how to edit in Adobe Premiere, and next thing you know,
nice.
It ain't easy, and it takes a lot of time. But if you're patient with it, you can put together some fun and cool stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's what I've always told people, because I've been, you know, nonlinear editing came in 20 years ago, and I've done so many different systems. But once you get it down, they're all the same, but a little bit different, you know?
Yep.
So if you get one down, you can transition into, I think I've done 6 different nonlinear editing systems in my career.
Right.
You know, so you just move on to the next one, and it takes maybe a few weeks, and you're like, okay, now I'm in a rhythm and I got it.
Totally.
So that's cool. You can teach yourself to do these things these days.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean, really, especially with YouTube, man, there's so many tutorials out there and so many just places that you can find information. Even like with the shirt design stuff, I'm like, I don't quite know how to do this. And you look up you know, how to, you know, whatever on, in Adobe Illustrator or in Premiere Pro.
Yeah.
And then you come up with a whole list of videos and you start watching them and trying to do it. And the next thing you know, you're like, oh, yeah, this is easy.
Yeah.
Like, it's, I mean, it's, you know, the same thing that we did in school, only school was official and YouTube is YouTube.
Right.
But it's right. A school of YouTube.
Right. Yeah. who needs Stanford when you got school of YouTube?
Right. No, man.
What a waste.
Yeah, and like, it's funny, like, the last couple of videos I've done, I worked with a guy that I found on Fiverr, and
yeah.
Just, you know, I did a bunch of research, looked through a bunch of dudes, and found a guy that was some dude in Mexico that was like, I like to create lyric videos for metal music, and
oh,
I was
whoa.
Like, I was like, great, you're my dude, and and you know, and mostly it's not like because I can't do it, but it's mostly because I started really wanting to focus on the artwork or focus on the apparel and all that kind of stuff. And I was like, the videos take time. And,
yeah.
And if I'm taking time doing the videos, then I'm not doing this other stuff. So
right.
that relationship just kind of worked out. He's working on a third video for me right now. And it's been super cool, but it's like, I love making the videos, but as soon as I start focusing on the next thing, like, you just got to pick.
Right.
And what you can't do yourself, time-wise, you got to at a certain point start hiring people out to do it.
Yeah.
So,
well, we were talking last week about kind of what we've been dealing with, right? You've been telling me some stories about some of the guys, you know, Blue Man Group type talent in this pandemic and what they've been, you know, jobs they've been applying for, and oh, I've yeah. applied for all these jobs and you know, can't get anything, and you've been applying for jobs and you don't even get a call, you know, and you look at, like, we've spent our whole career and built up to this, and, you know, what do you need? And but my point is, when you talk about learning a new skill, you've always been able to do it quickly, yeah. right? Like, oh, I need to learn how to edit. Adobe Premiere is the best thing out there right now. I'm going to learn how to do it so I can make a cool video, right? I've always been, you know, the same way. And it's interesting that the two of us are trying to kind of figure this thing out in this last year and, like, wait, but I can do it. I can do that. But tell me from your perspective what this has been like, because it just has gone on and on and on. You've been applying for real jobs too, which
oh,
people
yeah.
would be like, wait, this is drummer. This is Corky Gainsford, Blue Man Group, Code Red Riot. Otherwise, you know, he wouldn't need to do that. But that's what this has done to people. You know, we all got to try to figure it out.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And, like, I mean, my background before even going into the music industry, my background was marketing and event planning.
Right.
And my first real job out of college was creating a nationwide college band competition that I basically modeled after the NCAA, you know, tournament brackets.
Mm-hmm.
And found a way for there to be, like, local band competitions that went into an online band competition, and then the voting system happened, and then we got to the final four, and then the final four bands, we flew out to San Francisco, and they played the Fillmore opening for, ironically, Primus, you know, bringing the, but, like, it was this whole thing. So, like, I was like, I have this whole background in event planning and marketing that led into, like, what I did with Otherwise and, you know, in charge of both, like, not only just the budget and the financials of the band, but, like, the, you know, the merchandising systems and dealing with the record label companies and dealing with the lawyers and all this kind of stuff. And just, you have a lot of hats in a lot of different areas that when you step out of the music business, because it doesn't exist because of a pandemic, and you go, hey, I can do marketing for your, you know, fill in the blank company
yeah.
here or, and they're like, I don't know what you're talking about. You've been playing music for 20 years. And I'm
yeah.
like, well, playing music is part of it, but it, when you're in the business as a career musician, probably 15 to 20% of what I do is playing. And the other mm-hmm. 80% is, like I say, designing merch or,
yeah.
you know, reading through contracts or recording or, you know, writing or figuring out how to put on an event and dealing with the promoter and the other bands and the production. You know, I mean, there's
yeah.
so many pieces that apply. You can apply them in so many different areas, but I even had the same problem when I left college. I had majored in music, and I had put on concerts. The biggest shows that I did in college were with Beck and the Violent Femmes. I did a comedy show with David Spade in front of 5,000 people that was killer because David was backstage nervous asking me to walk out because I got to introduce David Spade, and he was like, can you make sure you tell him to, you know, try to keep the heckling down because I'm not used to doing a comedy show in front of this many people. And I get it. I mean, you know, comedians are used to, like, you know, small clubs and that kind of thing, like maybe theaters. And it was, we literally filled our amphitheater for a comedy show with David Spade. And it's one of my most vivid memories is him being nervous backstage before, before coming out there and killing it. It was awesome. So, like I say, like these are skills that apply to running any type of thing. But from the outside perspective, I left college and I'm looking into consulting jobs and various marketing jobs. And I would walk into these people's offices and sit down for the interview. And they're like, why aren't you going into the music business? And I'm like, there's no jobs in the music business. If I go in the music business, they want me to sort mail in the mailroom. And I'm graduating from Stanford, so I'd like a real job, please. And they're like, nah, go to the music business. And I'm like, no! So what ended up happening is I ended up getting hired by a dot-com company that was focused in music. You know what I mean? Like, that was how the technology and the music thing finally intersected for me and things. But, like, it's always been a tough thing to overcome for people to read through those lines. You know, so it's funny, like, the employment that I have found that really has only started up this last week is, like, with another guy in Las Vegas that has run events and known me for 20 years, and I'm, like, putting together LCD walls and running audio cables and stuff like that. I'm like, I know how to do that. You know, but it's like, you know, if I applied to any other company, I wouldn't even get past the door, but, like, this guy's known me for 20 years, and I'm like, I know how to do these things. Like, hire me. Yeah, it's a crazy, crazy experience. And I know you've talked about, like, you know, getting through the interview process and then getting to the end and them being like, yeah, you're overqualified. We're going to hire the 20-year-old.
Yeah, thanks. Just wasted 2 months. Really?
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks. Yeah.
But the pandemic, like I say, it's been there's been a lot of positives and there's been a lot of negatives. And then, you know, the hardest part is just keeping a positive attitude and finding ways to spend our time. And like with you creating this podcast you know, developing a backlog of material and showing that we know what we're doing. Like, it's funny, like the more that I post a video that I directed or post some artwork, then I get calls from people like, hey, can you do this design for me? Can you design this? You know, like, work ends up coming in after you do the stuff for free eventually. But you got to be willing to put in the time and put in the hard work. And like you say, you know, learn the platform and put some stuff out there. And then, you know, people will take notice when you're doing good work. And then some more work comes.
Right.
But it ain't easy.
It ain't easy, man. Hey, it's probably not easy for the people watching us right now. At least my end, my screen keeps freezing. I don't know about your guys's, but we got a lot going on because I'm adding these videos and everything. So everyone that's watching here on this live stream, we appreciate you. And if you want to comment or ask a question, I'll be monitoring it. I'll throw it up probably a few more minutes here with Corky. We've already gone over the time we were going to, but I knew this would happen, man. I knew this would happen. As we continue to talk, I know Scott's probably got a couple things he wants to throw at you. I'm going to throw up just an ISO of you drumming here. And, you know, we're talking about the better days, but they're coming soon. When you watch yourself in this type of thing, does it just kind of get the blood flowing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, because, like, back when you're learning how to play drums in your, you know, parents' living room, which is where I learned, and basically my parents, God bless their heart, they just went to the other side of the house and just turned the TV up real loud and let me play as long as I wanted to. I mean, this is the goal. So this gig you're showing here is a New Year's Eve gig. I believe it's 20...
Little Billy Idol.
Yes.
Idol here. Yeah.
So the guy in the hat, this is Frankie Perez. Mm-hmm. And Frankie's a well-known singer from Las Vegas. He sang for Apocalyptica for a couple tours. He's been in a group called Kings of Chaos, which is like kind of an all-star group of guys from like Guns N' Roses and Stone Temple Pilots and Linkin Park and this kind of thing that they kind of get together and do cover tunes. Frankie's in with this group. So the guy who you see on guitar here is actually Steve Stevens, who is Billy Idol's guitar player since the 80s and one of the most well-known guitar players over the decades. So Frankie's been in this circuit with all these like big-name players in L.A. and whatnot. So what we did was I came home from tour with the Blue Man Group, and then we did one rehearsal with Steve, and then we flew to Oklahoma and played this New Year's Eve gig with Frankie, Steve, and a couple other friends of mine that we tend to play a ton of gigs together here in Las Vegas. The other guitar player is a guy named Christian Brady. He plays in a band called Hell Yeah. And then Doc Ellis is on bass, who's played in a number of things in Vegas, and he filled in with Rat for a while back in the day. So it's all these dudes in different projects that, you know, you end up finding a middle ground of what tunes everybody knows. Usually it'll revolve around what the singer knows, right? Like, whatever the singer knows, dude, we'll just learn the material, and then we go from there. But obviously when you're playing with Steve Stevens from Billy Idol, you got to play some Billy Idol. So we did Rebel Yell that night, which is it's a lot of fun. That intro riff that everybody knows, most people in Las Vegas play it with two different guitar players, or they play it over with tracks, but Steve does it, does these two guitar parts at the same time. And it's like you sit in a room with that guy playing that riff, and you're like, yep, that's the riff. You know? Yeah. It's like we can all play the same music, but there's a certain thing about, you know, the guy that did it first and you know, with a certain bit of his style and just his approach to it. So these gigs are fun. And over the years, I've just started throwing up the GoPro more and more to get footage of the gig. And, you know, it helps me, you know, it helps me learn and watch back what I did good and what I didn't do good. And then, you know, it's a way to get content out there, which at this point we all need content out there of us, you know, like we're saying, proving what we do and prove that we do it well. So it's fun. Those gigs with Frankie are still some of my favorite gigs, and I've been playing like some funk gigs with him. The only gigs I've had through the pandemic have been like small private parties in LA with Frankie, and we play like funk tunes and old school dance tunes, and then play a few rock tunes. But it's so awesome. Like he's been really a great guy to play with.
Well, Scott and I, you know, Cork. I mean, we're both huge kind of live music fans, and just watching you, you know, kind of perform too. It's, I think everybody is obviously itching to get back to some normalcy and do what we used to do. Obviously, right. For you, it's your profession, but for people like me and Scott, that was a part of, right? Like, oh, let's, you know, married with a couple kids, or at least me was. I'd go see a show every 4 or 5 months, but it was something, right, that you could look forward to.
Yeah.
And Scott can speak to this as well, that we're all just looking forward to the day when we can come watch you, you know, with Blue Man Group or Code Red Riot or playing with Frankie, whatever it might be, because it makes us feel good, right? That's what music does.
I'll tell you, the worst part of the pandemic is when you're working – There's calluses here and here.
Look at those beautiful hands.
And now my hands are they're like artist hands, right? They're all nice and fine and clean. And they're like,
you look like a hand model.
Yeah, it is so like, and I literally haven't not had calluses or blisters for 20 years on these hands, and now like they're all gone because we're not playing, you know, 5 days a week or 6 days a week or whatever. So like when I do go to a rehearsal or whatever, like I have like band-aids all over my, cause I got to develop all those things. That's the worst part, is like, you know, developing the calluses and getting the blisters is the worst. And when this stuff finally starts back up again, you're going to see all these performers get back in certain shape that way. I mean, the same with like, you know, like if you're, you know, not playing basketball or not playing any sport, you know, like just, that, like when it's that first week of practice again and you're just in pain the whole time.
You
gotta all go through that.
Suicides, do it again. So you're saying like on stage there's gonna be this blood everywhere and everyone's gonna be like, what's with the blood,
what's going on?
Just my hands, man. Just my
extra
hands.
Band-aids, extra band-aids, we're all good.
All right, I won't boo then. I'll give you a little bit of a leeway there for the first couple months.
Well, the other thing too is like it'll be a bunch of people that after a certain amount of time, like, you got to pace yourself. And this is what, like, I mean, this is why I like watching college ball more than I like watching pro ball half the time, because the college dudes are like, they're just like, ah, we gotta go, we gotta move. And the pro dudes are like, man, I got a lot of games to play, and I got a lot of years in this career to cash these checks. So, you know, it's cool, man. There's always next play. And so, like, as a career musician, you at a certain point in time, you're like, dude, like, these are a lot of shows. Like, I got to kind of pace myself. Like, maybe I got to, you know, lean back a little bit, maybe hit a little bit less hard on the drums, like, you know, that kind of thing, to be able to play the next night, the next night, the next night. That's how, you know, a band like, let's say, you know, like the Bruce Springsteen can play 3 hours or whatever. They're not playing at 100%, you know, craziness for 3 hours. They got to pace themselves. So as all these musicians finally get back to hitting the stage, none of us are going to be used to pacing ourselves or wanting to pace ourselves.
Yeah.
So I would say see shows as soon as possible, because it's going to be a bunch of dudes going nuts.
Yeah.
Right out the gate.
Love it.
That pent-up aggression isn't just the fans, it's the performers too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because all of us have been just itching to go out there and do, you know, what we do. Like that, you know, this year is some footage of me with a band called Todd Kearns and the Anti-Stars, which Doc, who was playing bass in the Frankie band, he's playing guitar in this band over here. Other friend Mike is on bass. And Todd Kearns, who plays with Slash and the Conspirators, this is the guy in the center here. So Todd's a well-known dude from Canada. There are a lot of Canada transplants that have found their way into Las Vegas over the years. And so Todd plays bass with Slash when he's doing his solo tours. And when he's not on the tours, he plays gigs around Vegas as a guitar player, singer, that kind of stuff. So this band was killer, because we would do one show every month or two and try to cater the show to that month. So this was October.
Okay, makes sense.
And
right.
hence the spider webs all over my drum kit, hence the face paint that's on me, and hence the fact that we're playing Thriller.
Yeah.
Which the greatest part about, like, working with top-class musicians, of which there are a lot in Vegas, but, like, I've thankfully been able to play with a lot of top-notch musicians, is the show would be coming up, and with this group of people, we'd be like, okay, it's October, like, you know, are there any new covers we want to add into the set? And someone would just go like, oh, Thriller? And it's just like, okay. And so you just, you know, figure out what parts you think they are, and then you go to the next rehearsal, and usually, like, in, you know, one or two rehearsals, we would put together whatever covers we were doing. So,
yeah,
like, I remember when November came up, they were like, okay, so it's November, what are we doing? And I was like, dude, November Rain, duh. And
yeah.
Everyone's like, are you sure? I'm like, yeah, why not? And so next thing you know, like, we're learning, you know, November Rain for the end of the November show. But it was a lot of fun. And all those guys on stage from all these clips are like, you know, they're not only some of my favorite musicians to play in Las Vegas, but, like, they're some of my favorite musicians, period, in the industry. Like, they're all fantastic. They all got a, you know, style of their own, and when we're able to put it all together on stage, those are nights I don't forget. So, like, this video that you're showing is from audience videos, but I actually brought my Pro Tools rig and recorded multi-track recordings of the shows that we did with the Anti-Stars. So I had these, like, 16-track multi-track recordings, and I'd mix them together, started sending them around to us as just a fun way, again, for us to review our shows. And then during the pandemic, I was like, you know, it would be cool if I took these recordings and put them together with some fan videos and you know, posted, you know, high-quality audio along with it. So I did that right when the pandemic started. I started posting some of those old Todd Kearns videos with that multi-track audio, and it's been a lot of fun to have that up there.
So many things that you've been doing, man. You know, you make me feel bad as usual. Like, oh, I'm just gonna start a t-shirt company. I'm gonna do some artwork. Got my own thing going on with Code Red Riot, and
right,
you know,
right.
I'm just doing.
I'll show you this. Here, this is my second bestseller. which was a very selfish design. But because of all my black t-shirts, this one's my favorite. Because literally all that's in my closet is black t-shirts. But I did learn over time that I've really, you know, cut myself out of a lot of potential sales by not doing a blue version of this.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And a red version and, you know, green, so on and so forth. So one of my next things on my schedule is I need to diversify and have this for people who have a different favorite color of t-shirt.
Right.
Yeah. So you know.
Easy enough.
You can do this, Court. We believe in you, man. We believe in you.
Yes. Up soon at deletedesigns.com. You can buy your new favorite green t-shirt.
Your daughter, though, is an amazingly talented musician as well. That's got to be really cool for you.
It's been cool, man. She's a teenager. She's 13, turning 14, so she's definitely, like, figuring out what she does and does not want to do. And we put together a few songs and released them. She's released as the name Izzy Grace, IZZYGRACE. And I mean, those are songs she just like came to me with her ukulele and was like, I got this song. And I was like, dude, let's record it now. Cause, we recorded the first couple right before I left for the Blue Man Tour. We recorded another when I was home on the holiday break. And then like, it was funny. Like once the pandemic started and I was back home, she kind of started transitioning into more of wanting to do dance and hip hop stuff. She's been involved with a hip hop dance group for a while. And I think that's kind of affecting what music she probably wants to do and what she's been. So she hasn't really shown me a ton of stuff since. She hasn't really wanted to record. She's been kind of like, it's tricky. Like any musician or artist, like you want to put out there what you truly feel is good for you. Like you want to be confident in what you're putting out there. And if other people like it, great. And if they don't, fine, whatever. Like there's an audience for it somewhere. So she's trying to figure out what her voice is, and she's also a teenager, so she is more concerned about what people think. And I'm like, it doesn't matter. Like if you do it and you like it, people are going, you know what I mean? People will gravitate towards that. So it's an interesting thing with her. Like, and like I say, she's been focusing more on dance. So then I'm like, well, dude, like start writing some pop tunes and be like the next J-Lo or something. That'd be cool too.
Yeah. Right. Right. Support dad.
Yeah. But like whenever she wants to record, man, I'll record her. And I have another friend in town, Tony Carboni, who ironically he was the bass player that I brought into Otherwise, the last year I was in it before I left, but Tony's been producing some stuff and he's helped her on the last tune. And, you know, so there's definitely a support team for her. And so if there's more stuff, it might come out. And if not, you know, maybe we'll hear from her another 5 years or 10 years. Yeah. Or, you know, who knows what's next.
Well,
but
who knows?
Like she just writes stuff and I think I've changed a couple words, maybe changed a chord, you know, but I mean, those are her tunes. Like it's been super cool to watch. So we'll see what happens next.
Well, this has been fun, Cork, man. It's been nice trip down memory lane and,
for sure.
You know, I'm glad you didn't have to cut your hair all those years ago in high school.
Dude.
I'm glad that I was so good at basketball that I forced you to change your career trajectory. I'm really proud of that.
Hey, the other one, frankly, was when I lettered in soccer on my freshman year. I got my letterman jacket from lettering in soccer. I played junior varsity half that year, and then I played varsity the second half of that year. And then sophomore year, they moved me back down to JV. So by the time junior year rolled around and I was in varsity, I was like, I really don't care. So I played junior year. Senior year, by this point in time, I was like, you know what? I am never going to play soccer again. I'm going to play drums. So I answered some ads in the Seattle paper and started drumming in a band in downtown Seattle. And then all of us, I didn't tell anybody that I was doing this. And then soccer tryouts came senior year and I just didn't show up. And, and they're like, what are you doing? Where are you going? I was like, I'm playing drums. I'm so done with high school sports and all that stuff. I'm just going to play drums from here on out. And, And everyone thought
all,
I was crazy.
Let them all think it's the hair thing again.
Yeah. You know? but yeah, it, that was the beginning of playing clubs and going down that path. I just think I knew at that point in time that's what I wanted to do. And then not there were years where I didn't believe it, but there were, you know, it's come around full circle in the end. So that's
yeah.
pretty cool.
Well, best of luck awesome. To you here, man, in the coming months. Obviously, it's been fun just being friends with you for, geez, going on almost 30 years now.
Long time.
It's crazy. But, you know, better times are coming for all of us. And, you know, looking forward to seeing you perform live again.
For sure.
It's always been a thrill. And so, you know, I don't know if Scott has had the opportunity yet, but he knows that he's got to do it.
Yeah, yep. And Denver's always a big market for both rock and for the theater stuff. So, oh wait, you're Park City.
Park City.
So yeah, so Utah, same thing. That there's always like these nice little pockets in the country that I like to hit. So, but yeah, I'll keep everyone updated. With Code Red Riot, I've been aiming to have a new single out every 6 weeks. So my next single with Code Red Riot's coming out April 2nd. And that, like I say, with the way the music industry has been going, it'll just keep popping every couple of months. And then, like I say, there'll be more artwork coming at quirkygart.com, more clothing at deletedesigns.com. And I'll just try to keep everyone updated as best I can online.
Yeah, man. Hey, keep
we'll
up.
We'll be following.
Yeah, that's right. Keep up the good fight, brother.
You as well, bro. It's good to see you guys, man. Again, for sure.
Yeah, this is fun.
You too.
Episode 14, I'm not Steve Kerr, Corky Gainsford joining us for this one. It's been fun, and we'll see you guys for the next episode. We have no idea who that guest will be, so that's our tease.
And if we did, we're not going to tell you.
That's right. That's right. Cork,
right
it's been
on.
Fun,
thanks,
man.
Thanks, guys.
We'll talk soon.
Sounds
all right,
good.
Bud.
All right,
bye, guys.
Guys.